Hi, everyone.
Good evening.
This is Delilah from Imagine Publicity, and I'm the usual co-host with Donna Gore, Miss Lady Justice, every week at this time on Shattered Lives. In a little over a year, this program, Shattered Lives, has presented information about many people whose lives have been shattered as victims of various types of crime. We've had guests that have come on and told their stories. Other guests have offered resources for crime victims. They've taught us how to console and comfort. And we've hoped to have created a lot of new connections for the listeners of the show. This particular show is a little bit different. Donna Gore will be revealing her personal story about the murder of her father, actually 34 years ago this week. The person responsible for that murder, and another murder, by the way, is up for parole. And she's going to let you, as listeners, in on what happens to families and how they're affected long-term by the effects of a crime like this within a family, within a community. It's kind of the ripple effect, and it splashes into all areas of a victim's life. And joining us is attorney Michelle Cruz. Michelle is helping the family sort of navigate through the parole system process and hopefully help keep this person in jail or prison. So she's providing legal aid and support to the family as this is the first parole board hearing that they've had. So welcome, Donna. Go ahead. Take off with your show.
Thank you, Delilah, and good evening, Michelle, and thank you so much for being here, always supporting me, and it's much appreciated. So I'm wearing a different hat. My apologies for almost trying to go into the regular introduction. I kind of go on autopilot sometimes. So in any case, yes, this is a different hat that I'm wearing this evening, and as a homicide survivor since 1981, myself and my family have gone through many different phases. When you talk about grief, you know, the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, they're not in fact stages, but you go two steps forward, three steps back, and every person within a nuclear family and even the extended family or the other rings, as we learned about from Duane Bowers, have a different perception, a different take, a different way that you are affected. And my role within the family, I'm the oldest of three children and probably the most outspoken. And I guess the best way that I coped with the situation when my father was murdered was to go through the support process. They had a support group that was featured many different modules of training in terms of how do you cope with your feelings, things about the court system, et cetera. It was a 6 or 8 week program. In fact, I went through twice. And however, my siblings did not choose to go that route, and I became involved as an activist. I was one of the original board members and officers of Survivors of Homicide way back when Mr. Gary Merton was the president. So that was kind of my calling and how I got through the process. And believe me, it was a very long and arduous process because not only did the murder occur in 1981, and you think, oh, well, the crime will come up for trial in a couple of years, and that will be that. But this wasn't the case. It actually took 6.5 years until 1987, approximately, to come to trial, because this person was a career criminal, had drug charges in the state of New Jersey, had also committed a bank robbery a month after my father's murder, and also murdered the accomplice in bank robbery. So for a number of reasons, he wasn't available to be tried in a speedy trial, so to speak. So it only prolongs the situation, and or just when you think maybe you're getting your ducks in a row, it comes up again, and you are re-victimized. So I consider this next chapter actually a re-victimization, and everyone in my family is kind of in a different space, and for us to come together and to try to do everything we can to keep this person in jail is what we are going to do, particularly because there were so many mistakes and things that happened that shouldn't have happened in the first place. But also, as Michelle will tell you very shortly, this person should never have become eligible for parole. So in a nutshell, that's just sort of the bare bones of what happened without really giving you a lot of detail.
I mean, I can...
Go ahead,
Michelle. You go.
I was just going to say that with regards, I mean, one of the things that's been interesting, Donna, working with you is that, you know, you are an amazing advocate for yourself and for others, and yet there are still so many questions when it happens to
mm-hmm.
you know, and that everybody, every crime victim and has their own journey, like you said, but they're also entitled to have the support, get the answers they deserve, and feel that they know everything about the situation they're walking into. And, you know, and so it's been really interesting because you know so much, and yet there's still all these questions that we're trying to get answers to, so that you go into this parole hearing feeling like I have all the information I need to advocate and be a voice for my father. And and every victim should have that experience. And and something that I hope that someday every victim will have.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. Frequently they are not notified, or even if they're so-called registered, there's a number, particularly with the state of Connecticut, different layers of government agencies and different bureaucracies, and just because it's on paper that you should be notified does not mean that you know, everything that should happen does happen. And
Donna, maybe this might be a good time. Maybe Michelle can quickly sort of run down what is the normal process
mm-hmm.
for those listeners out there that maybe have never been in a situation that this family faces. What's the normal process that most people expect to go through when this happens?
Well, I mean, one of the first things that any victim who's out there should know is that they should know that they have a right to receive notification once their offender is incarcerated. And, I mean, we're talking post-trial and there's a conviction. And, you know, and notification means that they register with their information and it's confidential with either OVS or the Department of Corrections. And then what should happen is when the individual either comes up for release or dies or becomes eligible for parole, they're supposed to receive a notification letter. And that letter will tell them what this event is. So, like in Donna's case, she got this letter saying this individual who's charged with two murder charges, two convictions, is coming up for parole. And then what happens is they get a contact person, and in Donna's case, she got one of the two advocates at the parole board, and they kind of informed her, you know, you have this opportunity to speak to the parole board if you want to and make your wishes known to the parole board, because you have a right to do that. It's a public hearing. In fact, anybody can go to this parole hearing if they choose and watch or be supportive. And so what happens, though, is a lot of times, okay, you get notification, but notification of what exactly? I mean, for Donna, it was more than just he's coming up for parole. What does that mean? Why does he get parole now? What he was sentenced to 50 years and concurrently 25 or 26 years, why is he getting paroled now? There were a lot of questions that, you know, fortunately, you know, we were able to get some answers to. But notification means you'll get notice of the event. But then there might be a lot of questions that that family has. And if people haven't registered, or if, you know, the other thing is, a lot of people had offenders years back when they didn't have a notification system. So if you're hearing this and, you know, you've had an offender that's been in prison for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and they're still in prison, you can still register for notification at this point. But that system wasn't around a while ago. But you're supposed to be able to get information about what's happening with the offender.
But, you know, do in most cases, Michelle, do you find that really a lot of people may not know the right questions to ask to get information? They may not know who to ask to get the information from. I think Donna is so fortunate to be done what she's done over the years since this happened and be involved in the criminal justice system and have a connection with you. So what about the average person? Would they just kind of just get the notice and go, okay, and then show up and then not get the results that they're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what happens is, I mean, even with an in-court impact statement at the end of a trial, you know, when there's a conviction or there's a plea, a lot of times the victim's told, you're going to make an impact statement, or you can make your wishes known to parole. And the questions that the victim may have may not be apparent. Like what the information they need to feel safe, to feel heard, to be, you know, to be an advocate in a way that's really meaningful, they may not know what those needs are. And some of the things that I think are important is, well, what does this look like? Who am I speaking to? You know, do I speak to the entire parole board, or do I speak to, am I on video? You know, how much time will I have? How will I get into the building? You know, what happens when I get there? I mean, these are all questions that the victim has a right to know. And
it's been very unfamiliar territory.
Exactly. And, you know, for the victim, I mean, they're getting this news out of the blue. You know, by the way, it's not really 50 years. We'll just start parole at 26 years. So there's the Band-Aid ripped off. And then now you're going back in there, you know, and you're, everything's kind of brought up again and bubbling up, and you're going to go give an impact statement of some sort. And, you know, you have a right to know exactly what that's going to look like. You know, can I bring people with you? The answer is yes. You know, can I ask questions about this process? You can ask a ton of questions. You know, and if you're not getting the answers you want, there are a lot of other resources. I'm always a resource. Donna's a resource. Office of Victim Advocate. There's lots of resources out there, but you have a right to know what that environment is going to be like, and you have a right to know who you're talking to, how long you have, that you can give a written and or an oral statement. You know, one of the questions that came up with Donna and I talking is, you know, your mother was concerned that if this person gets denied parole, that he's going to come up for parole because of the statutes in 5 years. What if she's not there? One of the things we've been talking about is there a way to videotape that statement for the future so you can preserve the objection? But all these questions, in the minute that you get that letter, aren't apparent. You're just thinking about, how do I deal with this, and what's going to happen? And, you know, and I think that my experience has been many victims will just go, okay, and then they go to the hearing, and they're like, all right. And they're just kind of expecting the unexpected, and you don't have to do that. You have a right to get all that information and feel like you have all the tools you need to do what you need to do for your family or your loved one.
They really don't give you that much time. I mean, we just found out about this about a week ago or so, and here it is almost the 24th and one other week, and if I didn't have the connections and people that I know, then we wouldn't be in the same. I think we're going to go in prepared, and that really helps you in terms of feeling a bit more comfortable. I mean, the court system, the legislature, the parole board, it's all very intimidating process, and they go through their little spiels, but yet I feel as if, you know, we have to be heard no matter how much time we want to take, no matter what we say, and, you know, take whatever the perpetrator says with a huge grain of salt, because you know that person's, their only goal is to do or say whatever they have to in order to be freed, regardless of what they did before, or if they've been a good little boy, you know, in the recent past, or whatever. And I feel as if that person needs to respect our time, and even if they don't take it in or choose to do anything with this information, they should be there actively to understand from our perspective. This show is all about the aftermath. This person has sat in jail and gotten, you know, 26 years of three square meals, recreation, whatever, and has no idea, did not care about any of our family. Well, you know, this is the time that he's going to have to sit there and pay attention, if I have anything to say about it.
I think that, you know, one of the questions that's coming up, and, you know, hopefully we can solidify, is, you know, will he hear your statement? And
right.
And if there are victims in your family who do not want him to hear their statements, can
right.
that also be prevented? And those are good questions
mm-hmm.
that I don't think, you know, those are the kind of things that, you know, this is a journey that doesn't have to be more harmful than it needs to be. Like, this is, no matter what happens, going to this parole hearing is going to affect you. But it doesn't
right.
have to be this horrific event if we can get you all the information. And I really think knowledge is power. The more information you have, the more support you have, the more that you're going to feel like, okay, I'm empowered and I'm going to speak up for my dad, because he didn't have a voice, you know, back when this man took his life.
Right. In my not concern, but knowing how sort of routine and bureaucratic these things can be, because I've watched them on public affairs TV, and they have this little speech that they go through about, you know, talking to the person, going back into session. And the fact that maybe I have some questions that are not routine or kind of think out of the box, maybe those people would be taken aback a bit by saying, well, gee, I never thought about that, and we've never done that, and is that going to be allowed? Well, it should be allowed. If we can create new ground here in order to give other victims more flexibility in how they wish to receive and present information, Michelle, I think that's all the better. Because if you're just going to get up there and read a prepared statement kind of rotely, or, you know, you're too emotional to do it, and somebody else, the victim advocate who does not know you whatsoever, reads it, I don't think it has as much impact or as much meaning. And if you can do something or present it in a way that is meaningful to you, then maybe that opens the door for the next family.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things you've already mentioned is the short notice. You know, I mean...
Right.
That's something, that's a policy, or that's a technicality on how they do the parole hearings. And we can talk with them while we're there, you know, and say, this is something that we've let, you know, this person's been in prison for 26 years, and you're getting,
right.
the, you know, maybe a month's notice. There is a way to give you better notice, to give you 6 months' notice. I'm sure this person knows 6 months in advance are coming up for parole, you know, and that
mm-hmm.
may be not something that they don't think about. You know, although
well,
I feel like I've mentioned it 100 times.
I was told there was a lot of paperwork for the inmate to do, and that they had to do a lot of paperwork when they decide they had a choice whether or not to apply. And typically I was told that, and the term that was used was a lifer. He is a lifer. Typically, these people who are career criminals do not choose to apply because they have, you know, they have their routines. They have the security that they need of you know, being incarcerated, getting their meals, they have their structure. And typically, after being on the inside for so many years, they could not acclimate to the outside anyway without committing another crime to get back in. So I would venture to say that some people may be very surprised that this person even applied, because of the nature of the way that he has chosen to live his life, let's say it that way.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I do want to mention, since, you know, we're going to be also heard by people in Connecticut, is that there's one thing that's not clear about the Connecticut parole system, and that is, if you go to the parole board in Waterbury, then you can usually just call up ahead of time and tell them you're going to be there, you'll be on a list, and you'll be kind of escorted upstairs. But if you happen to be a victim whose offender's parole hearing happens in prison, you have to get mm-hmm. clearance ahead of time. So you have to notify the parole board, you know, almost as soon as you receive the notice that this person is coming up for parole, to make sure that you get cleared to go into the jail. You know, we had a situation with another family that some of the support people didn't know that. It wasn't clear, and so they weren't able to go be supportive because they couldn't get into the jail. And so I just want to mm-hmm. you know, take that opportunity to kind of let people know. That's why, how would you know to ask that question? Do I need to get cleared to go to the jail? Like, you wouldn't know that. So, I mean,
right.
Hopefully that
will. I think there needs to be much more than, Michelle, much more than just a two- or three-sentence form letter that is sent out. I mean, I think that's really poor.
Well, this kind of comes into the discussion about, in a process like this, looking at the rights of the criminal versus the rights of the, and, you know, here you're saying that this criminal gets about 6 months notice or to fill out paperwork and prepare himself to how is he going to look good in front of the parole board, where the family has possibly 1 month to prepare themselves. The shock wears off of even getting a letter like this. So where is the line drawn? What are the rights of the criminal versus the victims?
Well, that's a great question, because this is something that I think a lot of victims struggle with, because there is a distinct problem with the way our system is balanced. It's balanced on
the backs
of victims, basically. And the problem is that we still, some states are more progressive, you know, where, I mean, I prosecuted in Massachusetts, and victim-centered prosecution is what we did. Everything was about the victim. Not a perfect system. I went to the system as a victim, and it was horrific, but still better than some of the horrific cases I've seen in Connecticut. But there are still a lot of states where victims' rights are at its infancy, and at this point, victims have rights in verbiage, but not in enforceable, tangible rights. And so we're still working to educate. And that's why when a victim gets a letter like this, or when the victim goes in to give an impact statement, or when a victim becomes a victim, educating victims that you have a right to know what's going to happen. You have a right to be fully informed of what this process is going to look like. And if you feel like you're not getting the right answers, trust your gut, you know, because you probably aren't getting enough information, because people in the system still don't value the need for that victim to be fully informed, to have the opportunity to be heard, to have any question that's even anywhere in their mind answered, so that they don't get re-victimized. So we're still educating the people in the system. The system is based
yeah.
on constitutional rights of offenders, but, like, in Connecticut, victims have constitutional rights in the state constitution, and that should really mean something. And we're still looking at that. And that's why, you know, Donna and I have been going through a couple of different conversations about this parole hearing, kind of figuring out, you know, what questions she has together, you know, as a kind of like a team, what questions she might have, how can we get her that information, what information is available to her, how can we arm her to go in there and be, you know, strong, powerful.
And the other family members, because they're coming from a different perspective, we're actually going to meet for as a family, the other family members who are attending, so that they understand as well. You know, and I don't, Michelle, can you speak to the issue of what, with the volume of cases that people have, like the parole board victim advocate, what is actually her role, and whether you would advise somebody to, like, hire a private attorney to, if they didn't have a Michelle Cruz already in their repertoire of colleagues and friends, do you advise people to go outside of that system and try to get some additional help?
Well, I mean, there are two victim advocates in the parole board for Connecticut, and they handle all the victim cases. Now, anybody incarcerated coming up for parole, 95% of the time, there's going to be victims. I have heard many times that a lot of victims don't come to the parole hearings. I think that's more because a lot of victims don't know that the offender is being paroled, or they get that letter and it's overwhelming and they just can't absorb the information, and then they don't maybe get the answers they want, or maybe they don't have transportation, or maybe they don't know if they're going to be safe and they just can't go there. And so they're just kind of, receiving a form letter, that's not, to me, I'd be like, oh my God, like, what does this mean? And how do I get more information?
Right.
Not everybody feels like that. A lot of people might feel, oh my God, you know, I can't even deal with this, and put it somewhere. Or they've moved and they didn't realize that their information wasn't, you know, forwarded or whatever.
It wasn't updated.
People can always, you know, send me emails or questions, and, you know, same with you, Donna, I'm sure, you know, we are resources. But, I mean, the bottom line answer is, if you don't feel like you're getting the answers you need, then you've got to keep asking. You've got to keep asking people until you find the person who can sit down with you and explain the system and advocate for you in a way that's meaningful. And that may be someone like me, that may be someone like Donna. You know, finding someone, it may be Delilah. I mean, having someone that can get you the answers you need, connect you to the resources that you're entitled to, so that you feel comfortable. And I'll give you an example. I was working with this particular victim, and it involved a murder case. And they had met with the prosecutor before, and you know, I would hear this all the time. They didn't really understand what the recommendation from the prosecutor was and what was happening, and, you know, they were just confused, and I don't blame them. I mean, when someone's murdered, it is very, you're getting all this jargon and you're not exactly sure what's being said, but it involves you and you're not sure and you're confused and you don't want to ask too many questions because you don't want to, you know, you just don't want to be that person who's asking so many questions that you become, you know, you feel like you get self-conscious about it, which I encourage you to ask questions until their office closes if you have to. Then I went with this person to the meeting with the prosecutor, and I was writing down what they were saying, and then I asked questions like, okay, when you say, you know, this is a murder case and you're not going to refuse it, does that mean this and this? And I was asking all these questions, but peppered throughout our meeting were little comments like, well, we told the victim this. You know, we had this conversation, and I kept having to remind them, well, I know you did, but I'm asking you because I want to be clear, because the victim wasn't clear. And so
there was almost an error of
don't ask any more questions. You know, we're busy, and I don't care how busy anybody is. The only case that prosecutor or advocate should be concerned with is the one involving you as a victim. And, you know, until you have all your answers that you need and you're done, that is the only case that should matter. And and so, I mean, in the end, this person walked away feeling like, I have a good idea of what's happening. I feel like I have a strong handle on the fact and the situation, and I can move forward and not be confused. And that's what,
like, they're more empowered.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of terms that apply to our case as well as other cases, and I just wondered if it might be helpful to help define it for people who are listening, because they may also, you know, are the person who murdered my father had a concurrent sentence with the two murders, and also there was a concept called determinant sentencing versus indeterminate, and so things like that really play a role in what the outcome is. And do you think it might be helpful to just explain a couple of those terms in a general way? And then our case was put together with two juries because the people that were involved in both murders were essentially the same. So they did one jury, one panel of jurists, and they would alternate in the morning. They would talk about the trial involving the perpetrator with my dad, and in the afternoon they would switch to the other person who was killed. And there's a concept in law named joinder, where they're putting cases together. Now, irrespective of whether that was the best thing to do, it was or it wasn't, how do you help victims explain those kinds of things so that they can better understand what's going on?
Well, I mean, the joinder thing in your case, I got to be honest, that was nuts. You know, normally joinder is not two jury panel, like one jury panel hearing two separate cases. Usually the trial is joined. So it's one fluid trial. I mean, that's why you're in all the law books, you know, because that was a very extraordinary circumstances where a lot of the confidential informants or the informants were the same parties. So they're trying to do that. And they tried to do that in the Pettit case as well at one point. But the one thing that's interesting or should be explained is that when there's a sentence, when there's two different crimes, they're either going to be concurrent or consecutive. And in your case, the two murder charges, the convictions, were run concurrently, meaning they're running parallel at the exact same time. So he's basically getting, you know, a twofer. He's getting the same exact sentence, even though it's 50 and 25. He's getting the same sentence for the two crimes. He was also
and not having to pay for the second one, right?
Exactly. I mean, the other thing is that he was part of the old good time credit program where he received all his good time credit up front. And then if he didn't behave, it should have been forfeited. And, you know, we're still trying to figure out what this is because we have since learned that there is a consecutive sentence for a crime he committed while in prison, meaning he committed another crime while in prison. And the judge who sentenced him told him that new sentence against I believe it's a corrections officer, is going to be served after you get out and get paroled on the murder cases. So it's a stacked sentence. So he serves the one to the end, gets paroled, and then serves the second one. And so one of the questions that comes up is how does someone get good time when they're committing and being convicted of crimes while in prison? And that's still a question that's kind of out there that we're not sure if he actually did have to forfeit any of his good time. And that's a question that victims have a right to. A lot of victims, you know, are still have offenders who are in jail with these indeterminate sentences or determinate sentences with the old good time, and they have a right to know, did this person forfeit any of their good time? Did they commit any crimes while incarcerated? Whether or not they're going to get those answers, they still have a right to ask, you know, what did happen and what is going on in this case.
Can you explain to everyone what that is? Like, what is good time and how do they earn it? And wasn't there a time in our state when it was, like, revoked and then reinstituted? Or I could be wrong on that. I don't know. But and why would they get it in advance? So what is good time about?
So good time was originally, you know, back in the day when this particular offender was sentenced, they would get, like, he was sentenced to 50 to life, 25 to life. So he automatically concurrent he automatically received whatever good time he would receive during that period, he would get that up front. So it would be taken off his sentence. And then if there was some kind of quote-unquote bad behavior, they would forfeit some of that good time. Then they got rid of the good time credit completely, and then they brought it back into 2011 and post-dated it to April 2006. The new good time credit is earned monthly, 5 days a month, and can be forfeited after, you know, quote-unquote bad behavior, whatever that would be for DOC these days. But it's not given.
And are they days that are earned like every month, like we earn vacation days at state government or sick time or whatever, and it incentivizes the prisoner to be good? Is that what the concept is?
The concept is that, you know, they wanted to reward prisoners for doing things that are supposed to reduce recidivism. And unfortunately, the policy that was in place at the time, you could write your name and get credit for good time, just for writing your name on a list for a program that you haven't completed. I'll give you an example of how good time really works well. In one particular jail in Massachusetts, they have a program where if you get your GED, you get a certain amount off your sentence automatically. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's an attorney who said that nobody leaves that jail without a GED. And she's been an attorney for about 12 years. That's a positive, you know, because there's a set goal and there's a set result, and people are accomplishing that goal, which will make them, you know, less likely. And this is a House of Corrections to misdemeanors and below. It will make them less likely to commit crimes because now they have either a diploma or a GED. What we did in Connecticut was, you know, a whole another show about a good time credit, but they. You know, I'm understanding that they're fixing a lot of the policies in response to the loud outcry about that program. But that is the goal. I mean, the ultimate goal is to get people to come out and be, rehabilitated. But they actually have to do programs that address their core issues to get that.
So what you're saying essentially is there's a whole plethora of things that you can earn good time for that you really shouldn't be earning good time for because it really doesn't mean anything or they really didn't do anything to earn it.
Well, what happened was, I mean, we looked into a lot of these cases when I was with the Office of Victim Advocate, and one of the examples that I gave was one individual was a sex offender and he received good time credit for taking a program on the history of the Philippines. That's not going to change his sex offender.
What?
It won't change.
So what do you think of that one? Oh my God!
But that and so I mean, and there were certain programs he was supposed to take, including sex offender treatment. But the history of the Philippines, I mean, that's great, that's entertaining, but that's not going to change that core root behavior, and that's what that's what the program was set up to do. And so that was the big issue was, you know, whether or not these taking the history of the Philippines, although educational and entertaining, really didn't change behavior.
Wow. Yeah, that's just incredible to me. And, you know, a long time ago, about a year ago, I wrote a blog on prison programming. And, I used our state as a model. And just by happenstance, I looked through all the material online, and there were 264 pages of programming for prisoners. Now, granted, it wasn't in every geographic area offered to every prisoner all the time, but 264 pages and then 1 6-week counseling session for the families. So what do you say about the programming aspects for prisoners?
Well, I mean, I did the same thing, which was so interesting. I know we talked about it a few weeks ago, and there were at the time 410 programs for offenders. And some of them, you know, are for, you know, and my theory is, you know, nonviolent minor, you know, offenders, many of these programs actually would be helpful. But there's 2 points I guess I want to make. The first one is a lot of the programs are, like, there's one that allowed the prisoners to become a barber. and it was like a kind of a lengthy program. But many felons can't become barbers. They can't get a license. So you're setting people up for failure. There are also a whole lot of referee and like coaching type programs. A lot of these offenders are not going to be able to get a job or, you know, get employed in that venue because they're going to be prohibited.
Oh, you mean like sports coaching and all that?
Yeah, referee programs. So, I mean, a lot of the programs didn't make a whole lot of sense towards, you know, making someone successful. And then the other issue I had was that our system is really imbalanced because, like you said, homicide victims get 6 counseling sessions, which is enough to rip the Band-Aid off and make someone hurt really bad, but not enough to really help them become successful in dealing with the trauma that they've been through. You know, a lot of victims end up, you know, because of the crime, because of the trauma, because of maybe having to relocate, maybe the financial backlash. You know, we had a young victim of drunk driving who ended up in a whole lot of debt because of the crime. The person was uninsured. She had some major medical rehabilitation and injuries that, you know, she couldn't work. She literally could not work. And then she had to pay for her motor vehicle. She had to pay for the medical bills. And she ended up in, you know, in a very difficult financial position. So we have victims who end up being harmed financially, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and we don't offer them, you know, educational programs or, you know, free tuition to get college degrees. And some of the programs in the jail, I know that some of the offenders have to pay to go to these college courses. Some of them are donated. Many of the victims, like life skills, like all these programs are equally beneficial to victims, but they're not offered to victims. And I'm not saying we need to even everything completely out, but that there needs to be more focus on how does the system respond to a victim who's been financially, emotionally, spiritually, mentally harmed by a crime. You know, aside from victim compensation, how do we help these victims stay on a positive path, rebuild their lives so they can be successful, and so that, you know, that the harm caused by the crime does not, you know, end up being so expansive that it just bottoms them out. I mean, there's a way to do that, and there's a way to balance out the system without completely toppling the system. And I just don't see us doing that. You know, I mean, there's employment incentives for hiring a felon at Home Depot, if I recall correctly. You know, what about hiring a victim? There's no incentive for hiring a victim. And at some point, we need to look at that. We need to look at, you know, the way that we treat victims, you know, and the way that our system responds to victims.
Well, don't you think it would be fair that every service and every program that is offered within the prison system should also be offered to victim services and their providers so that they can provide the victims with everything that's available to them should be available over here so that, like you said earlier, the system is balanced. There's no balance here.
No, I mean, I remember hearing about one particular college, which will remain nameless, in Connecticut that was offering free courses to offenders. I'm like, that's great. How about offering free courses to victims?
Right.
You know, how about offering, you know, just maybe a couple of free courses? You know, maybe just thinking about, you know, I mean, like, there's, I'm not saying that the offenders don't need the program, but that the victims have needs too. And children and victims' families, like, we've got to look at the way our whole system responds to the families, you know?
Right.
And I did want to mention, so we mentioned notification, and we mentioned answering questions and asking questions and having support people. We need to also mention victim compensation, because so many victims I come across, you know, in my work now and my work before, have no idea that victim compensation is out there. So if you're a victim of a violent crime in Connecticut involving injury and Massachusetts involving violence, you can apply. And there's some limitation, like 2 years in Connecticut, 3 years in Massachusetts, but you can also apply afterwards if you have a good reason that you didn't. And you can receive it some compensation under certain circumstances. And it's not a lot of money, but sometimes it's enough for the counseling, medical bills, you know, lots of support.
It covers funeral expenses, right?
It covers funeral expenses to a certain amount. But, I mean, it's a resource out there that is often, you know, overlooked or not communicated, or communicated, but when someone's in trauma, they're not able to take it in. And so I just need to, I feel like we need to reiterate that always.
Yeah. So that piece of it isn't really marketed too well, that it sounds like.
Well, I mean, I'm not really sure what the issue is. I mean, I don't know why some victims aren't receiving that information. And, you know, some of it I think is, you know, victims, there's a certain population of victims whose offenders are not captured, who may not come in contact with the system, right, the courts or the police and victim services. And they may not know that victim compensation is out there to cover funeral expenses, counseling, and what have you. So that's one reason why that happens. And then the other reason, I'm just not sure. I mean, in Connecticut, there's one victim advocate for the GA and one for the JD. And, you know, Massachusetts, there's like five or six for the equivalent district court and five or six, sometimes eight for the superior court. So there's a whole lot more advocates. I don't know if that's the issue, but, you know, it's really about making sure that victims know, okay, these are all the resources that are available to you, and you're entitled to them. And if you have any questions, you gotta continue to, you know, ask. And sometimes I think what happens is they hear about it in passing in the beginning, and then it's about like just getting up in the morning, getting through the day, going to bed, and starting over. And sometimes it just feels like it's too much to really look into all these things. And there are people who can help you do that, you know.
Right. I definitely agree with everything that you said. I think we need to somehow, you know, humanize, personalize, make it more balanced. And, I proportionally, I'm just wondering, you know, in our case, I was walking around with rose-colored glasses and thinking way back when, you know, the initial detective said, oh, this guy will never get out. Well, how many people proportionally come up for parole that are bad guys, violent offenders such as this one? Is this like a really, really unusual case, or what do you say?
I don't think it's unusual. I mean, the hardest thing for me over the last 5 years and then continuing forward is hearing victims tell me, well, I was promised this person would never get out. And then I have to look at them and say, that may very well not be true. You know, I mean, one thing is, like in your case with the good time, you know, they knew from the beginning he was going to serve 26 years and come up for parole. Like, that was the mathematical equation they had then. They knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they told you that was inappropriate. And then the other thing is, you know, we just retroactively in 2011 changed all these sentences. So, you know, everybody gets, if you do earn risk reduction credits, you're getting 60 days off your sentence. You know, times that by 10 years, it's a pretty big chunk of a sentence being taken off the offender's sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the victims may, you know, in many cases what happens is the victim says, well, that person's never getting out, and they put that whole incident, that whole crime, all that trauma, and they just put it away. Like, I'm not going to think about it. And the reality is that sentence very well could have changed, and that the truth that that person's never going to get out may not have actually been a truth. And so some people spend the rest
really
of their life
hard
in prison. You know, I mean, when someone's sentenced to 60 years and it's a murder, and it was not this other sex thing that you're talking about, this good time credit, they're actually going to do a good chunk of their sentence. But that isn't always the case, you know. Like a manslaughter case, those individuals are coming up for risk reduction credits 60 days off their sentence every year, even though it's manslaughter, even though it was truly probably a murder that's happening. So one of the things to do is, people can go on the Department of Corrections website and look up the offender and look up the information, and it'll give you kind of a ballpark, but then look at the offender in another 6 months and see if the parole eligibility date is going down, because that'll tell you whether or not that person is getting credits and if their sentence is being reduced over time. But just monitoring the offender's sentence online, you can do that as well.
Yeah. Well, are they allowed to describe the nature of incidents that happen while they're incarcerated? Because we were never told anything specific, only that he was getting in trouble, and we just learned the nature of and the seriousness of those crimes just a few days ago.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure. There's kind of like a cloak of confidentiality, which is not really clear to me why, over a lot of what happens in DOC and the Department of Corrections. So I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. What I did do when I was looking at your case is I went on the Connecticut Judicial website to see if there were any charges on there. And then we later learned that this person hasn't been in trouble since 2002, which is, 11 years, so it's probably not going to show up there. But if let's say the offender had been, charged in jail for an offense and actually prosecuted, it's going to show up, if it's recent, it's going to show up on that judicial website, and you're going to be able to see it. And no, that's one of the good things about Connecticut is you can see convictions from, dating back, I don't know when they started doing that, you can see recent convictions on the website.
Right.
And so that's really a good tool. But,
I'm so-and-so, and you give them proof of who you are, can they divulge what the crimes are if you call and ask?
No, like if you called up right now and called DOC and said, I want to know what all of his discipline tickets are, I don't think they're going to tell you. We can have that conversation when we go to parole. And see if they'll tell you, because now it's going to be in, they're going to look at his record in public and they're going to probably say something about what he's been doing for the past 26 years. And so it'll be in public, so you can ask questions there. And, I would, I'll be sitting next to you going, ask those questions, it's going to be in public, why not ask,
So we actually have more time. We can ask those questions of the parole board versus just having our one shot getting up and reciting or reading our impact statement. We can
I'll give you an example. I think I gave you this example the other day. I remember, so someone cracked my son's taillight on a car. And I remember I went to the police department. And the police, and it's definitely vandalism, whatever. So we go to the police department, and the cop comes out, and he's standing in the lobby, and he goes, okay, so what's your statement? I'm like, really? So I take him, and I take him over to the conference room, and I sit him down. I'm like, I'd like to sit down and give my statement. And he's like, okay. So I'm sitting there, and I'm giving him my statement. He would have been happy with pretty much most crimes having me just say whatever I needed to say right there in the middle of the lobby. I tell you that example because, what is the parole board expecting you to do? They're expecting you to come in, read a statement, and leave. But I'm telling you, I would read a statement. I'd first ask some questions, I want to know a little bit about, can I get some information about what's been going on for the past 26 years? This is my father who was murdered, and this person's up for parole. They may be like, but at least you're asking,
Right.
And you may very well get some information that they had not intended to have to, you may very well get some information. Yeah. But what they're expecting is they're expecting you to make it easy. Give your statement, shake everybody's hand, walk out, thank you very much, next. And we don't have
believe me, that's not Lady Justice.
No, but I'm saying,
Michelle, with you had talked earlier about the volume of cases that advocates in the parole board and how is this going to be just kind of like a meat market sort of thing?
Do they really truly listen?
Do they really listen to the evidence? Do they listen to the victim's statement? What can she expect out of, even if this perpetrator listens to it, is he really going to care?
Yeah, I really, I mean, I've been to the parole board a couple of times to do presentations. They really do care what the victim says. And they really
I've seen it on TV. They seem to care. Or they even are very respectful of the prisoner. Good morning, Mr. So and so, and oh, I understand it was your birthday yesterday. Happy birthday. And I mean, oh please. And then but then most of the ones I've seen, I haven't seen victims on there giving their statement. But I have to say that the ones that I have seen are respectful of whomever is there.
Yeah, and I mean, when I talked to the parole board, I did my couple of different trainings with them. We generally want to know what they can do to make victims more comfortable. They really want the victims to give information about, you know, how the case has impacted them. I mean, the victims going in there with a completely different perspective than anybody else, you know, and the offenders in there to sell how well or, you know, how mediocre or whatever they've been doing. The parole board has their entire history, hopefully, in front of them and knows, you know, that they'll know that he was in New Jersey and then he came up here and then he committed these two murders and then he assaulted someone. They should have all that information. Yeah. And so you're bringing this completely different perspective, like, hello, right. I am the one who represents the man's life that this guy took,
right.
You know, and you're bringing that information and you're talking about, you know, how... You know, 26 years ago, you were told this guy is never going to get out. And then here you are, you know, and your mom's
right.
having, you know, some thoughts about, well, what if I'm not here for the next parole board to fight this guy getting out? I mean, that's what's continuing to happen for this family. And they need to hear that. And I do think it affects them, you know, and I do right. think it shows that, you know, even though it's 26 years, which seems like a long time, it's not for the family because that pain never goes away. And I think that they're very receptive and I think they're very interested in knowing because every victim has a different experience and every victim has a different kind of what they've gone through over the years. And, you know, it's really important for them. I mean, that's the impression I got to know exactly how this family has been impacted and what's the balancing. You know, this guy may be doing, I mean, I don't know, but he might, let's say he's doing great and the family is still here, still struggling. And you know what? 26 years is not enough for two murders. It's not.
No,
and so,
it's not.
You know, having someone say that.
The ironic part is they know nothing. Here they have a thick file of all of the activities. You're lucky if they barely even know any of the victim's family's names. They know nothing about this person, and you're supposed to get up there in 10 minutes and wrap up 26 years of torment and pain. Where is the equity there? There isn't, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's why knowing how much time you have and, you know, getting prepared is really important.
Right.
You know? I mean, not just for the results, but also for yourself, you know, to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really see that, you know, doing the victim impact statement, whether it's, you know, at sentencing or at parole, is really for two reasons. You know, the first one is to get the person to either go to jail or stay in jail or to get the services they need or whatever it is you're advocating for. And then the other one is for your own health and well-being. You know, to have a voice in something that you probably never had a voice in the first place. You know, and even if, you know, it's like maybe you did know the person or whatever, like to have a voice and to not be silent in, you know, something that's, you know, affected you in a negative way for your own,
right.
you know, just your own well-being. Because a lot of times, you know, let's say someone goes in there and the offender has 3 months left on their sentence and they're going to a parole hearing. Well, they might feel like, why should I even go? Well, it's important. It's important to, you know, the parole board to hear, you know, you might release this guy, but I want you to think about releasing this person. And I want you to think about the fact that this person has caused harm to other people, and I want you to know the victim's perspective. And even if you release them, you're not going to release them without me, you know, coming up swinging. But some victims
right.
are not going to be able to do that, so they can also just, you know, mail a letter and have it be read to the parole board or have the parole board read it, but they can still actively participate without having to go there if they choose not to.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of variables to consider, that's for sure.
Well, you know what? I hate to cut you short, but our time is gone. And this, I think whatever you and Michelle can offer listeners and readers about this whole process and your personal journey with it, I think it would just do wonders for other people to get the information, just in case, you know, maybe help mm-hmm. the next person.
Yeah,
so, Donna, I'll let
cool.
you go ahead and close the show with your own thoughts.
Okay. Well, my own thoughts is that I think it's very important to have someone in your corner to try to understand what you're going through, someone who is knowledgeable and able to help walk you through the process. That's going to make or break the situation and make you be able to present yourself in a way that the parole board is going to take pause. You know, they may think they know what they're going to do with this person on paper, but it's so important to have a voice and appearance. And I'm so glad to have Michelle Cruz on our side. So I just want to say thank you so much to Michelle. And Delilah, thank you for all of your support, too. You've been a wonderful friend in this and continue to be. So we will continue to let you know what happens with this, and we can only hope for a good outcome that he continues his incarceration.
I don't know if we're out of time. Are we out of time?
We're done.
Okay.
Yeah. Will you come back?
Thanks. I think we can always bring Michelle back, right?
Oh,
yes,
yeah. I'm always
can.
Available.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, say goodnight, Donna.
Good night. Good night, Donna. Good night, Chet. Good night. Thank you, Michelle. Delilah, thank you so much. I will speak with both of you soon. And please, everyone, do stay tuned for another episode next week. And I will do a blog on this. And be sure to listen on the archives. So good evening, South Carolina.